make my way to the lee side of the Jeep, which was shaking from some kind of thunderous music being played on its stereo. I paused for a second and remembered another time on the mountain when I'd been assaulted by a different kind of music, drums specifically. I waited patiently as the driver rolled down the window about 4 inches and looked out at me. His voice was agitated. "What the hell are you doing walking in the middle of the damn road?" I breathed a laugh and had a coughing fit from the cold of the high-altitude air. "What the hell are you doing speeding down a mountain in this weather?" He was middle-aged, a little chubby, and in his early 50s, with black hair and a black goatee, a Hollywood smile, and a black down jacket with a black Greek fisherman's hat. On closer inspection, even the Jeep was black, black being the new black. I glanced at the Wrangler. It probably had about $30,000 worth of modifications, and from the decibel level they were mostly in the stereo. "You mind turning your music down?" I hung an arm over his side mirror and took a few breaths as he did as I requested. He seemed a little worried, and I guess I would have been, too, if I'd found somebody traipsing up West Tensleep Road in the middle of a high-altitude blizzard. "I'm Sheriff." I cleared my throat. He rolled the window down a little farther. "What?" "Sheriff, I'm Sheriff Walt Longmire." "Oh." He seemed uncertain as to what to do with that information. "Are you okay?" "Yep. You haven't seen a fire called Sprite go by here, have you?" He looked at me, blank like a freshly wiped chalkboard. "A what?" I pointed toward the tracks in which he was driving. "Big snow cat, square like a very large lunchbox." He shook his head. "Nope, we pulled onto the main road from our cabin and started driving out. Haven't seen anything except you." I shifted the knapsack farther up on my shoulder, crouched against the Jeep for cover, and could see a blonde-haired woman in the passenger seat. "How far up is your cabin?" He paused and glanced at the woman before resting his eyes on me again. "Look, Sheriff, if you are a sheriff, I don't want any trouble." I fumbled with the opening of my coat and tried to unbutton the top button so that I could show him my badge, but my gloves made it slow going. I finally got my jacket open enough so that he could see it. "There." He stretched out the next words. "All right. I need your help." He really looked worried now. "To do what?" "Give me a ride back up this road." He looked around as if to emphasize the point. "You're kidding, right?" "No, I'm not." He sighed and placed the palms of his gloves on the steering wheel. "Sheriff, we've been listening to the radio, and they say that you guys are going to close the roads." "They're already closed in both directions on 16. Once you get out of here, you're only going to get as far as Tensleep Canyon to the west and Meadowlark Lodge to the east. If you've got food, supplies, and heat, I'd advise you to go back to your cabin till the Wyoming Department of Transportation guys can break through." He glanced at the woman again, and she folded her arms and looked out the other window. He tipped his hat back and looked at me. "Actually, the electricity went out about an hour ago." I thought about all the cabins I knew of on the mountain. "Don't you have a secondary heating source?" "A what?" "A fireplace or a stove?" He nodded. "Yeah, there's a fireplace." "Firewood?" "Yeah." He sat there without looking at me and then spoke. "We think we'd rather take our chances." I stared at the side of his face. "You're not listening. The roads are closed. And I've got 3 sheriff's departments, search and rescue, a couple of detachments of HPs, and the majority of Wyoming Department of Transportation shoveling their way up here. If you go on, you're going to end up sitting on the roadway waiting for them to clear it. And if they don't do that before you run out of gas, you're going to get very cold. My advice is that you go back to your cabin and let me borrow your Jeep." He set his jaw and stared at the instrument panel with a disinterested nonchalance. "We'd rather go ahead." I thought about how I could just commandeer the Wrangler, but how far would that get me and how much time would it take? I took my arm off his mirror. "When you get down to Deer Lodge, don't go in. There's a guy cuffed to a water pipe in the main building. My advice is to head east. You'll get as far as Meadowlark. One of my deputies is in charge, and they had power the last time I was there. That's probably your best bet." His mood suddenly brightened. "Great, thanks." I felt like smacking him, but instead rebuttoned my coat and started past. It would appear that no matter the price, the boatman was not going to ferry me across. Not losing any time, he gunned the motor, and the shiny black vehicle leaped forward, the rear fender extension clipping my hip and bumping me. I watched after the retreating vehicle as he squirreled it in an attempt to get away. The music surged back up, and I'd swear they were laughing. Happy motoring. I made the mile to the Battle Park cutoff in pretty good time, but the thiokol hadn't cut off. I shined the maglite up the pathway, but the calf-deep snow on the road was pristine. I reached up and banged the tin sign, loosening the snow that revealed the large black numbers on the yellow background, 24. I wanted to make sure, knowing how easy it was to mistake distances and directions in these conditions. The tread tracks continued on the main road toward West Hensleep Lake. Maybe they'd missed the turn and had taken the one from the north. I tucked my head down into my jacket and continued on another couple of hundred yards, but the arching entrance onto 24 from that direction was also vanilla cake smooth. The tracks continued on 24 toward the inescapable highest point in the Bighorn Range. Once again I stood there, dumbstruck. Where the hell were they going? There was only one way to find out. I kicked off and after another mile could see where the jeep had pulled out near the Island Park campground. I looked down the short road that must have led to the jeep driver's cabin and thought about the firewood in the fireplace. My legs were unused to the added exertion of walking in snowshoes and were tired. I could get a fire started and warm my feet and hands, the parts of me that were approaching numb. My sorrels and snowshoes stamped in the tread tracks, anxious for me to make up my mind. Well, hell. I trudged on, but I didn't get far. The snowcat had stopped again, and this time it was only another quarter of a mile up the road. They had pulled to the side, and then it looked as if they had sat there for a while before moving on. I scanned the area with the maglite and looked for another message. I could see where at least two individuals had gotten out of the thing, and that one of them was big, with shoes as large as mine. He had walked on the side of the one access road that led off to the left and then disappeared into the trees. The other had followed. The thiokol, on the other hand, with five remaining occupants, had continued north. It was possible that they'd dropped off the two women and that one of them was wearing the boots of the Ameritrans guard. It was also possible, as Vic would say, that flying monkeys were soon to appear out of my ass. I clicked off the flashlight and changed direction, remembering that Omar had said something about having a cabin on West Tensley, past 24, and up near Bear Lake. I followed the footprints to a rise leading to a hanging shelf from which I could see a large old house. Through the blowing snow, I could make out the shape, but there were no lights on. According to the couple in the jeep, the power was out, and it certainly looked as if that was the case here as well. The road continued along the tree line until it ended at the site of what only Omar would call a cabin. As I got closer, I could see that it was a log and stone affair, and something any of the rest of us mere mortals would have called a house, a very large and extravagant house, which overlooked the frozen, snow-covered, and partially visible expanse of Bear Lake. The Forest Service was pretty strict about remodeling any of the historic cabins in the Bighorns, especially the ones not only in the National Forest but adjacent to the wilderness area. You were not allowed to change or expand the original footprint of the structure, but Omar seemed to have overcome that hurdle by simply going up. The front of the cabin was oriented toward the lake, with an overhang supported by huge burlwood logs. The extended deck stuck out from a massive set of archways below, with an overhanging shingled roof above. Even in the limited visibility, I could make out the four sliding glass doors that led to the deck, but other than a diffused light deep within the recesses, possibly from a fireplace, I couldn't see anything inside. I continued to follow the boot prints and stuck close to the tree line with the flashlight still off. If they were looking, there wasn't any sense in advertising like a used car lot. The wind was carrying the smoke from a fire in the other direction, but I could still smell it. I was reassured by any aspect of normalcy and came up on the garage door side of the building. The doors were closed, but there was a walkway to the right that must have led inside. The prints, however, led to the left and around the building next to a rock retainer wall where the drifting snow had piled up. All I really wanted to do was get inside, so I decided to try the nearest door. It was unlocked, so I pushed it open and stepped through into a lengthy mudroom with a washer and dryer. I quietly closed the door and then stood there for a moment, just orienting myself from being outside. I still leaned to the left as I had done all the way up the road and drifted forward, countering the effects of the wind and the movement of the snow. I slowed my breathing, stood up straight, and looked down the oblong room at another door one step up. There was still no noise, but as I'd expected, the flicker of some fire fractured a warm light on the glass panel. I slid the flashlight into the retainer loop on my belt, took off my gloves, stuffed them in my coat pockets, and unbuckled the snowshoes. I unsnapped the safety strap from my holster and drew the large frame coat. I took another deep breath, carefully stepped across the mudroom, and peered through the corner of the glass pane. There was indeed a fire in the fireplace, and, to my relief, Omar Rhodes was standing at the center island of the kitchen, his back to me, a dish towel over one shoulder. It looked like he was eating a very large sandwich. I turned the knob and held it as I stepped up onto the hardwood floor, which was partially covered with what looked to be a vintage Navajo rug. The hardened snow sloughed off the sides of my sorrels onto its red and black wool. I glanced around the timbered structure, which was illuminated by a few candles that flickered from the draft. In one swift movement, the big game hunter swung around and leveled the business end of a Model 2944 Magnum at the bridge of my nose. It took quite a bit to not counter-raise my Colt, but I was assisted in not moving to action by the twisted wire loop handle of a cleaning rod that stuck comically from the barrel of the big revolver. I just froze there, first making the strongest eye contact with him that I'd ever made, and then looked around the rest of the room. By the time my eyes got back to him, he'd lowered the Smith & Wesson, and the cleaning rod fell from the barrel to the floor between us. He was leaning against the butcher block counter with one elbow, exposing the blood-soaked surface of his shirt beneath the towel wrapped around his armpit. He tossed the blued and engraved revolver onto the island amid the other cleaning supplies. The heavy weapon made a frightening clatter. Omar's voice was thick with drink, fatigue, and possible blood loss. "Took you long enough." From all appearances, there was no one else in the room. "Are we clear?" He breathed a whistling laugh and stretched his eyes to keep them open. "Clear as a noonday sun." He picked up his Dagwood sandwich. "You cleaning that, Smith?" He glanced at the detritus on the counter, which included a tumbler and an ancient half-empty bottle of Laphroaig. He bit into the sandwich and mumbled, "Yeah." I knew from experience that he cleaned his guns only when he was upset. "Settling your nerves?" It took forever, but he smiled at my knowledge of him. "Yeah." "You're hurt?" "A little. Bullet went into the refrigerator, took out the ice maker." He gestured toward the massive stainless steel appliance behind him. "Better it than me." His voice trailed off with the crackling of the fire. "You got visitors?" He breathed the same laugh, smaller this time, and then looked up at me as if surprised that I was there. "Wasn't the Girl Scouts?" "Where are they?" He paused as if trying to remember. One's in the bathroom. The other one's over by the door." I took a few steps toward him, but he turned a hard shoulder toward me and held a hand out. I'm good, but you better go check him." I nodded and directed my .45 toward the entryway across a sitting room in the back. I stepped over the head of a massive Kodiak bear rug and could see something lodged against the front door. The stained glass of the door panel was shattered, and the blowout from an exit wound had sprayed in a spot a foot wide with foreign material embedded in the wood. The liquid pattern narrowed in a sliding path to a solidifying pool of dark blood and the slumped and inert body of Marcel Popp. There was one of the Sig 40s in his lap, and I used my boot to flip it from between his outstretched legs. His head had lolled forward, and the back of it was pretty much gone. As a formality, I lowered a hand and placed two fingers along his neck but could feel the unnatural coolness of the postmortem flesh and no pulse. I stooped a little more and looked at the side of the big convict's face. There was a jagged hole at the left cheekbone, from which thickening blood slowly dripped, his still eyes following the path to where his life had drained. I fought the urge that my legs telegraphed to collapse under me and take a rest. I stood and looked out the shattered door. The shot had fittingly exited through the middle of a rose-red triangle, and the insidious cold pulsed through the hole as if the wilderness was attempting to give back the bullet and the death that it carried. I wavered there for a moment, then turned and looked at Omar, who was intently studying the crystal in his hands. He reached behind him for the bottle, poured a full four fingers, took a slow sip, and returned it and the bottle to the counter.
"Happened fast. They knocked on the door, and I don't answer the door at 3 in the morning up here without accompaniment."
I crossed back toward the kitchen, but stood a little away from him. The bullet he'd taken must have clipped him below the main tendons in his shoulder and above the clavicle, but it still must have hurt like hell.
"Said their car was stuck. I let him in, but when I turned from the door, he raised up that automatic and got a shot off. I guess maybe he saw the mag in my hand and it spooked him."
He breathed heavily, and I could hear a faint whistling sound.
"Got me in the shoulder, but I don't think it hit anything important. Still works."
To emphasize the point, he raised the arm a little.
"Rolled to the side when he fired again, and I put one in his head."
I found myself nodding. "Are you sure you're all right?" He breathed some more.
"Yeah."
He picked up the tumbler with a sickly smile.
"Sterilizing from the inside."
He took a large swallow.
"Funny, I'm hungry as hell."
He took another bite of the sandwich and chewed.
"You want half of this?"
"Maybe later."
"I'm horny, too."
I took a while to respond to that one. "I don't think I want to help you out with that, either." He laughed, and the timbre of it was a little higher than I remembered, and a little unnerving as well. I gestured toward his sandwich. "It's a normal, life-reaffirming process. Kicks in when you really think you're going to die and don't. The urge to reproduce. Eat. It's when you almost lose your life that you really start appreciating it." Omar was staring at the counter again, so I switched to another topic, a more urgent one. "The woman's in the bathroom?" He glanced up. "Huh?" "He had a woman with him. She's in the bathroom?"
"Yeah."
"Where's that?" He used his good arm to gesture after picking up the scotch.
"Down the hall."
I began to turn, but stopped when he started to go for the scotch bottle again. "Omar?"
"Yeah?"
"Stop drinking." He didn't move.
"Right."
We stood there like that, neither of us so much as twitching. "I mean it. I may need you." He set the glass down, and I made my way into the hall. There were 3 doors. The nearest was closed, so I knocked on it. There was no answer, so I knocked again. Someone whimpered, and it didn't sound the way an FBI agent would whimper.
"Beatrice?"
There was more keening, and I leaned in closer to the door.
"Beatrice, it's Walt Longmire, the sheriff from the lodge. Is it okay if I open the door and see if you're all right?"
There were no more sounds, and I did what I had to do, turning the knob and carefully opening the door. It was dark in there, but I could see a body wrapped around itself and wedged between the bathtub and the toilet.
"Beatrice?"
She started when I spoke again. I slipped in sideways and holstered my coat.
"Are you okay?"
It was a stupid question, but I had to open with something. "Do you remember me?" Another stupid question. I started thinking I should try some statements.
"Beatrice, you're not hurt."
She mewled into the crossed arms that covered her face above her drawn knees.
"You're going to be okay."
"Nothing."
"Are you hurt?"
I kneeled down and leaned against the side of the tub, the burning in my legs attempting to overtake me. She didn't appear to be physically damaged, but continued to huddle against the wall. I carefully reached a hand out to her.
"I'm here to help, Beatrice. I need to know if you're okay."
The moment my fingers grazed the sleeve of her jacket, she yanked back and screamed and didn't stop. Her eyes were wide, and she stared at me with the fierceness that only cornered animals have, animals like the one I'd encountered on the roof of the cabin at Deerhaven Lodge. I didn't move at first, but finally allowed the leg under me to collapse, and I slid against the far wall, my hat falling into my lap. I sat there looking into the ferocity of her eyes, not unlike the ones I'd encountered on the roof of the cabin at Deerhaven Lodge. I didn't move at first, but finally allowed the leg under me to collapse, and I slid against the far wall, my hat falling into my lap. I sat there looking into the ferocity of her eyes, and took all they could give. Chapter 7. She sat on the sofa near the fire, and was wrapped in a rust and ivory striped wool blanket that had a band of Lakota ghost ponies woven on the edge, as I attempted to bandage Omar's wound. I placed the affected limb in a sling made from a couple of monogrammed linen napkins from William the Samoan, as Lucian Connolly referred to the purveyor of fine tableware. Omar looked up at me, and I could see that his eyes were starting to clear a little at the pupils. "You'll help me bury the body, right? I mean, that's what friends are for." I had finished my own ham and cheese, and tried not to watch the pot of water on the propane range for philosophical purposes. He was still drunk, but I'd found a French coffee press, unsure who needed the caffeine more, him or me. I'd gotten him to sit on one of the fringed leather bar stools and retrieved the finally whistling kettle. Carefully pouring the boiling water over the grinds in the glass contraption, I stood there for a few moments thinking about all the things I was going to have to do before heading out after the remaining escaped convicts. Henry had a French press, and from the many times I'd seen my friend go through the procedure at his house, I probably should have waited longer for the coffee to brew. But I had work to do. I depressed the strainer to compress the grinds, and poured three of the Obar R. Buffalo China cups to the brim. I turned and sat one of the heavy mugs in front of him. "Drink that." He nodded, and I picked up the other two mugs and moved toward the sofa. "Beatrice, how about a little coffee?" She stayed crouched in the Pendleton blanket with her legs curled under her. I had found her glasses, and they reflected the flames of the fireplace. It was as if I were looking into two miniature hatches of a firestorm. "You want anything in it?" I stood there for a minute more, and then crossed the rest of the way and sat on the edge of the cushion beside her. I could see that she was shaking. "If you drink a little something, you might feel better." The eyes shifted behind the mirrored blaze, but didn't make it all the way to me. I took a chance and held the mug out in her sight line, between her and the roiling fire. She finally looked at me, and I smiled. "Coffee?" She took a deep breath, letting it out in a shuddering release that seemed like an exorcism, and the words that came from her were barely audible. "I like tea." I felt like laughing, but couldn't risk the energy. "Would you like me to make you some tea?" She nodded, just barely. I'm not sure if she really wanted tea, or if it was a way of insulating herself for just a little bit longer. I refilled Omar's coffee with the contents from Beatrice's cup, and with his help, found a box of Earl Grey bags and submerged one into what was left of the boiling water. I lifted the edge of my improvised sling to check the patch job I'd done on the big game hunter. It looked like the bleeding from his shoulder wound was subsiding. "How you doing?"
"Fuzzy, but I'll get there."
He yawned, which emphasized the leonine aspects of his features. "He was...
I'd tried to..."
He stopped speaking, and the only noise was the popping of the pine logs in the fire. I studied him.
"What?" He took a deep breath. "Nothing."
I clamped my jaws shut to keep from yawning in sympathy, thinking about how much further I had to go, wondering how far that was and what I'd find there. I thought about my plan, or lack of one. They were mobile, and unless Omar assisted me, I was not. They were many and well-armed. I was not. The only thing I had going for me was the topography, the simple fact that they would soon have nowhere to go. They didn't know it, but they had bottled themselves up, and other than Tyrell Ranger Station, the concrete, not-so-portable potties were the only indoors in all the great outdoors. They would have to stay in the Thiokol for the night, so I could grab a few hours of sleep, and maybe that would help me clear my head. I looked at the shine in my friend's eyes and thought about how many creatures Omar had killed and in how many exotic locales, only to slay his first human being literally on his own doorstep. I lowered my voice. There's a conversation we're going to have, but not in front of her. He nodded and slowly sipped his coffee. When I got back to the sofa, Beatrice was still hypnotized by the fire. I stood there feeling the heat radiating against my back, pulling at my sore muscles and prickling my skin. The waves of exhaustion washed against me like an ebb tide, causing me to waver a little. I forced the air from my lungs and blinked to clear my eyes to find Beatrice's looking up at me. She took the tea and held it in front of her face, in clasped hands. "Thank you." I waited, but she didn't say anything else. I have some questions.
I bet you do.
She looked away from me, back to the fire.
The heart has its reasons, that reason knows nothing of.
Pascal. She looked at me again. I tipped my hat back. I've been thinking of moonlighting at the local community college. It took a while, but she did laugh, and then laughed again. When the words came out of her, they weren't the ones I was expecting.
He's not as bad as you think. He's not a simple misanthrope.
Aware of the Stockholm syndrome, I still wasn't sure what to say to that. Excuse me?
I was sure you knew when I told you I was from Makuta, and you mentioned the Red Wing factory, that there's a maximum security prison just down the road.
No.
That's where I met Renaud. And I guess I was vulnerable, but he's so, well, I don't know, charming, kind of. And he loves me, really.
She froze for a moment, and I was worried that I'd lost her, but then her lips moved and she began speaking again.
My father had just died, and I was struggling with a thyroid cancer diagnosis and a divorce. I was working at a veterinary clinic, and maybe it was coming to terms with my own mortality when I started feeling sorry for the number of dogs that were exterminated for lack of adoptive owners. A friend of mine suggested I start a sell dog project with the prison. You know those programs?
I figured this was the only way to get her talking, and I was curious about how she'd gotten tangled up with Shane. I've heard of them.
I interviewed Renaud for the program, and we argued at first about which method produced the best trained dogs, discipline or positive reinforcement.
Want me to guess which one he believed in?
She sighed a laugh. I asked him which one worked best with him. She tucked the blanket in a little closer. He was magnificent with the dogs. Had a real talent working with the most vicious animals. They loved him. I think he saw a reflection of himself in them.
A hand crept up and stayed there at the side of her head.
One day he complimented me on my hair. She looked up at me. I know I'm not very much to look at, Sheriff, and that's probably why it struck me the way it did, like water on a dying plant, I guess.